From San Francisco to Paris, Nashville to Amsterdam, we're reaching up.
This is John Fass in San Francisco, and we're reaching up again this week with music, some cool wisdom, and special guests.
Hi, this is Tom Paxson, reaching up with Don. Peace. Let it begin with us.
Good morning, Mr. Blue. We've got our eyes on you. The evidence is clear that you've been scheming. You'd like to steal away and while away the day. You'd like to spend an hour dreaming. Well, what will it take to whip you into line? A broken heart? A broken head? It can be arranged. It can be arranged. You are flying to Vienna. You have phoned aboard your airplanes. Sit at oaken tables. Speak in solemn tones while the leaders of all nations keep a deep respectful silence. You're moving pawns and bishops made of flesh and blood and bones. But the white bones of Allende and the scattered bones of Chile are to scream the bricks of silence of a thousand blown away. Oh, the white bones of Allende and the scattered bones of Chile are not silent. They are screaming, they're your peace prize, Dr. King.
Tom Paxton, 60s folk icon, singer, songwriter, activist, and 2009 Grammy Lifetime Achievement winner, our guest today. This is Don Fass, and we're backstage at the all-new, it's more than refurbished, it's redone from scratch and relocated Freight and Salvage Coffee House in Berkeley, California, and with me is Tom Paxton, who you may not know, but I've kind of known you since maybe 1965, and I remember very specifically seeing you at the bitter end in 1970, and then at the War is Over in Sheep Meadow Central Park in 1974, and probably several times before that with Peter Paul and Mary, my old friends, and lots of other people.
Funny how those dates don't sound that long ago until you stop and think about it.
That's true. Let me start off by asking you, before we get to a lot of new stuff, for those people, probably half our audience or more, who have no idea what Greenwich Village was like in the mid to late 60s, paint us a picture.
Well, I got there in 1960, which was a nice, neat way of doing it, I guess. And I think that the salient feature then was it was the end, the tail end of the Beat Generation, at least as it was known in commercial terms. Poets declaiming in the coffee houses. When I first started coming into the village on weekend passes from the Army, the Gaslight, which became really one of the seminal clubs, the Gaslight featured poets, beat poets, one of whom turned out to be Wavy Gravy, and later my roommate, but that's another.
we could do an hour on that,
oh,
probably.
Oh, my God, could we ever. So the folk singers were kind of interspersed between the poets, as it were. That didn't last long. Pretty soon, the folk singers were what the entertainment was all about in the village. Now, it was, as I say, the end of the Beat Generation. It was it was blowing in the wind. The straw was blowing. It was the ferment was coming. The civil rights movement was gathering momentum and finding great support among young white college educated kids in the North. And all of that was turning into ferment, and meanwhile, on the commercial front, the Kingston Trio had several huge number one albums. So what passed for folk music was very, very popular all of a sudden. So there we were, we young guys in the village, Van Ronk, Oakes, Tom Rush up in Cambridge. We were all learning how to perform. I was writing songs. It turns out I was one of the first ones to be writing songs. I didn't notice that. But we were learning guitar styles, and feeding off one another. We were competing with one another and supporting one another at the same time. You know, it was a pretty close-knit community, which is not to say cliquish. New people were welcome, but we stuck with each other a lot. But it was exciting. The sidewalks on the weekend were impassable. Tourists coming down initially to hear beat poets use the F word, which was extremely titillating in 1960. But then later to come down and hear the folk songs.
Now, by the latter 60s, a lot of people might not realize it, but among all the people who were there, at some point Ritchie Havens was painting portraits on the sidewalk, I think before he was performing.
I never knew that.
Yeah, Bruce Springsteen was in a high school band called the Castiles, appearing at the Cafe Wa. Of course, nobody had ever heard of him. And so when you talk about new people and established people, but this was after the days of the TV show Hootenanny, right?
Yeah, Hootenanny was on in, 64, maybe 65. And we boycotted it. We boycotted it because they were blacklisting Pete. The producer of Hootenanny was Fred Weintraub, who owned the Bitter End, for Christ's sake, where Pete had appeared. And, you know, when he was called out on it, said, well, they weren't blacklisting Pete. They just didn't think he could hold an audience. And of all the absurd comments I've ever heard in my life, that's up there in the top 10.
Now, we could, if we had hours, which we don't, we could go into how, of course, Pete Seeger, for those people who don't know, was called a communist.
And he was a communist.
Was a communist, and that's why he was blacklisted. And that really didn't end until the Smothers Brothers.
That's right, yeah. And you'll notice that they didn't exactly rush to book him on other shows after the Smothers Brothers managed to get that thrown. Now, Pete had been, like many people, had been in the Communist Party in the 30s and early 40s, but he left it very early. I've spoken to him many times, and I'll let him speak for himself, but he certainly... he's no communist today, but he is definitely a lefty, just like yourself and myself. But for him,
you know, some people on my show are hearing that for the first time. So I'm coming out as a lefty.
Coming out as a lefty. Well, sorry, folks. I didn't mean to blow his cover, but the guy's a lefty.
I can't wait to some people hear that. Of course, Pete Seeger ended up many, many years later, decades later, getting such things as the Kennedy Center honors and being honored for all his work on the environment and the Sloop Clearwater and cleaning up the Hudson River and many other accolades.
Well, he can never be sufficiently honored, if you ask me. Somebody told me, somebody on fairly good authority, that eventually there's going to be a footbridge over the Hudson that's going to be named for Pete. And who better? There are those of us who have been signing petitions for Pete to get a Nobel Peace Prize. Once again, who more deserving than he? None more deserving than he. Pete's it. Pete's the whole ball game for me. He always has been. He's my hero.
Recently, members of my family learned how powerful natural disasters can be when a tornado ripped through their town. But you know what? The Red Cross was there to help. I'm Demi Lovato for the American Red Cross, asking you to text message the word GIVE to the number 24357 and donate $5 to the Red Cross Disaster Relief Fund, where they can provide shelter, food, counseling, and other assistance to victims of disaster. That's GIVE to the number 24357. You can send up to 5 text messages, so please text today.
Now, mentioning the Kennedy Center honors and Pete, congratulations to you for getting the 2009 Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award.
Yeah, I'll tell you a funny story about Pete. I was on the Prairie Home Companion after the Kennedy Center honors, and my wife was with me, and we were chatting with Garrison and complimented him because, if you'll recall, he was the master ceremonies for the portion of the Kennedy Center honors that honored Pete, and complimented him on doing an excellent job of that. And he said that to see Pete Seeger getting out of a limousine, wearing a tuxedo, Toshi in a long gown, was to see a man on the way to his own hanging.
I had the privilege of going to, when I still lived in New York, to several of the annual Clearwater revivals,
sure,
which were a great place for music and for learning about,
yep,
how to take care of this earth.
Yep.
And that also reminds me to ask you about the song that you wrote and did, Whose Garden Is This?
Whose
Garden Was This? Yep. This was really early on.
First Earth Day. We write songs for special occasions and usually sing them once or twice and let them go. But I still sing that song because I like the song. I like the way it worked out. I think it said what I wanted to say very nicely. And so it's in my show kind of semi-permanently.
Whose garden was this? It must have been lovely. Did it have flowers? I've seen pictures of flowers, and I'd love to have smelled one. Whose river was this? You say it ran freely. Blue was its color. I've seen blue in some pictures, and I'd love to have been there. But tell me again, I need to know. The forests had trees, the meadows were green, the oceans were blue, and birds really flew. Can you swear that was true? Whose gray sky was this? Or was it a blue one? Nights there were breezes. I've heard records of breezes. And you tell me you felt one. Tell me again, I need to know. The forests had trees, the meadows were green, the oceans were blue, and birds really flew. Can you swear that was true? Whose garden was this? Must have been lovely. Did it have flowers? I've seen pictures of flowers, and I'd love to have smelled one.
Well, thank you so much for that, because I think many generations have been inspired by that song, and it really, as you said, because it was for the first Earth Day, I guess it was 1970?
70, yeah.
I was up in Boston Common for it.
Mm.
The times now are tough, and there's a lot of confusion. And back in the 70s, and I suppose back in the 60s, there were the birchers, now we have the birthers,
yes,
and all this other craziness, and people calling President Obama a communist. What do you think of what's going on now? And what do you think, I know it's a very broad question, but what do you think of life in these United States now, in comparison to the late 60s, let's say?
Well, the one thing that immediately springs to mind is that we have a president in whom I, for one, believe. I suggest that many people do and can believe that this guy is so far superior to the presidents we had in the late 60s as to, be on a different continuum. So that's different. I think the level of rancor is no greater than it was then. I mean, it was bitter, bitter, bitter. I mean, we were losing thousands of our young people in Vietnam. God knows what the Vietnamese were losing. So, birthers. I mean, I think the birthers were birthed by the birchers. You know,
probably so.
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to see their birth certificates, you know. They should just grow up. And that goes for Sarah Palin, too. Just shut up and grow up is what I would suggest with a smile on my face and love in my heart.
Of course, now we have something we didn't have in the 60s. We have the 24-hour news cycle and all the news channels and pseudo-news channels and bloggers and everything else. So perhaps everything is not, it should be transparent, which would be great, but it's also blown way out of proportion, I think.
Yeah. Do you tweet?
I finally started tweeting about 3 months ago.
Have you really? I wouldn't know how to go about it.
But I do it once a week. I don't do it, once an hour.
What's the difference between a tweet and a blog? Oh, well, a blog, you can type as much as you want, right?
And of course, and you can do the same. I mean, tweeting is just, in effect, sending an email with 180 characters.
Yeah, I think actually tweeting should be restricted to limericks and haiku.
Be perfect for haiku.
Yeah, and limericks too.
But instead, I think a survey found out that 70% of people who tweet, and businesses tweet, everybody tweets, but 70% of people who tweet about the most ridiculous nonsense, like, I just cooked my soup.
How come I don't get any tweets? Is that, and you have to sign up
You have to sign up, and then you may regret it.
Oh, no, this is wonderful. This means that I need never get one.
That's true.
That's wonderful. Yeah, God, I wish spam were like that.
I wish spam were like that, too. I wanted to ask you, you kind of get into a different area of society, but first in a very gentle way. Tell us about your children's book. I know you're touring and doing book signings about that, too.
Yes.
How'd you get into that, and what's the book about?
Well, I've been in it off and on for a long time, but this new is because Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul & Mary brought out a book, a children's illustrated book of Puff the Magic Dragon a couple years ago. And his publisher at Sterling left Sterling and started a new company with Peter called Imagine. And the first thing Peter called me up and said the first book they wanted to put out was The Marvelous Toy, which is a song I wrote in 1960. And people might not recognize the name, but they do recognize it went zip when it moved, then bop when it stopped, then whirr when it stood still. So I said, yeah, let's do it. And these people dedicated themselves to putting out the best possible book of that song they could possibly do. And they saw the illustrations of dozens of different artists and narrowed it down and finally chose an artist from England named Steve Cox. And I didn't have to write anything. All I had to do was say yes. And so they brought out this absolutely beautiful children's book with a CD that has four songs on it, The Marvelous Toy, duh, two others of my children's songs, and an instrumental version of The Marvelous Toy. And it's a beautiful package, and I'm thrilled by it. So connected with gigs I play around the country, I go and do bookstore appearances, too. I've done a couple here.
And, of course, people, besides finding it in bookstores, can find out all about it and everything else you're doing on TomPaxton.com.
Yeah, they can go to .com. They can go to Amazon if they want to. And, you know, Amazon, they could probably leaf through a few pages of it and see how beautiful the illustrations are.
You've been around through all kinds of movements. We've discussed some of them a little bit. You've seen all kinds of changes, although you say that things weren't all that different with Nixon and what was going on then and the Birchers. But what do you think of life now and what kids have to deal with in this society? And let me also ask you what you might like to see happen.
Well, I think what I see right now that disturbs me so much is the level of out-and-out hatred when you can have a Congress interrupted by an elected representative screaming, "You lie," to a president of the United States, flip for a minute and imagine that congressman's reaction if a Democrat had shouted, "You lie," to George Bush in that same room. He would have, you know, been ready to tar and feather. But he felt so empowered by his righteous rage that he felt that he could do that. I think the man, first of all, should be turned out at the very next election. But what it really worries me, the level of rage and bullheaded refusal to compromise in any way, to think, to speak civilly to someone of a different opinion than yours. I can't get over that. I can't get behind that. I feel able to sit down with that guy and discuss, you know, what he thinks. What's your story? And, you know, without coming to his side, without getting to know exactly what the guy's trying to get through, without trying to kill him. I mean, I can't stand all the hatred that I see around me.
Well, look at what just happened the same week with the president's about to take place address to school kids.
Oh, I know. And that, you know, the same people who held their kids home from school, this is in Dallas, correct me if I'm wrong, but next week are scheduled to take busloads of them to the new Texas Dallas Cowboys Stadium to hear an address by George W. Bush. So who's making politics of all of this? Not the president. The president's doing what presidents have always done, talking to school kids, saying, "Stay in school." It was an inspirational talk.
Besides what President Obama said in that talk to school kids, and apparently a lot of them did get to see him, and kids are pretty smart, and they can find it on the internet, too. What else? I don't mean President Obama, but what can all of us start teaching kids so that all this craziness doesn't go on and we don't have future generations hating so much?
You know what? You got me, Dan. You got me. I think we need to teach the children to respect one another a little bit more. I think we need to teach them to look people in the eye when they talk to them, speak up, tell them what they think, listen when someone else speaks. Just common courtesy is what is a good place to start.
One of the things that we would say, and we've actually had people who on our air were kind to the right but very spiritual, uh-huh, and very into social justice nonetheless,
uh-huh,
and I think what they would say and what I would also add to the conversation is that we need to teach kids, whatever their beliefs,
mm-hmm,
that we somehow all come from the same place.
Yeah. Well, I have quite a few conservative Christian friends, and we're kind to one another. They respect me and I respect them, and we don't need to go into trying to prove to one another that the other is wrong or anything like that. We can just get along. I'm a lot happier getting along with people than I am, you know, getting all upset and head up and get down. I can't stand all that crap. I'd rather calmly tell someone my opinion and listen to theirs than you know, drop the gloves and go at it.
I had a really nice experience several months ago. First of all, over the last year and a half, I got to know a big-time Christian British group called Delirious. Hmm. And they're kind of a bit more Christian version of U2.
Okay.
But they also play stadiums as well,
yeah,
as churches and,
yeah,
all that. And the leader of the group, who's an incredible songwriter, is a guy named Martin Smith. The third time that I met him over the last year, I brought him a Salute to President Obama CD that we put out about 6 months ago.
Uh-huh.
He thanked me for handing it to him, and he looked at me and he said, "So what do you think of this guy?" And without getting gigantically political, I just told him, "I think, you know, this is the best thing we've had in,
uh-huh,
a long time, and,
oh, yeah,
and I hope society takes advantage of that and understands that." To me, that's the way to communicate with people.
Sure. I tell people that Obama is the first politician who has reached me since Bobby Kennedy. And I tell people I'm out of the country a lot, you know, so I get asked a lot. I say, I'm happy as a lamb of two mothers to have this guy as president right now. Can you believe it? Look at the guy. We have a black, intelligent,
compassionate,
hip, cool president. I think we need to get behind this guy. I think we also need to goose him. I am unhappy that they seemed to have agreed to stop mountaintop mining, strip mining, and then somehow it resumed. I don't know exactly what the deal was there, but I'm very unhappy about that. It's the one thing about the administration that I'm really shook by. But basically, I love the guy.
Of course, we're waiting now to see later this year what happens with the public option, or whether it's put off for 4 years, or there's a trigger, if one can understand that. But to have somebody in the White House who basically says there are some things that we've put off for decades, and this is the time.
Yes.
I mean, that's wonderful.
I love that, yeah. We're not putting this off anymore. This is going through. You think it started with Truman. No, I believe that we're going to have a very good, imperfect health care bill. And I'm going to be screaming mad if it doesn't include a public option. But I think of Teddy Kennedy and I say, take what you can get, but move ahead. Later we can do that if we have to. But my line right now is I'm screaming, do not sell out the public option. The thing is that I'm almost 72 now. I've been around a long time, and I've learned, gosh, they really don't listen to what I have to say. Nevertheless, I'm going to say it. I'm going to say public option. We have to have it. And if we don't get it, but we get most of everything else, I'm going to say grumble, 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 good.
Are you still writing political songs?
I'm writing some, yeah. I'm a little stumbling right now because I get so angry that I find, you know, I bore myself. So at the moment, I'm just writing whatever songs come to me. And I haven't written anything absolutely political for a little while, but I have plenty of political songs to sing, so it's okay.
With the incredible career that you've had so far, Tom, anything left that you'd still like to do?
Oh, well, there's, you know, daydream stuff. Like, I'd like to write a piece for the theater. I've always loved the theater. I studied theater in University of Oklahoma, and I loved acting, and I love writing. So I'd like to write something for the theater, but you don't just say, well, today's the day. You kind of have to get into a different mindset, put a lot of stuff aside, and concentrate on that and that alone. And I just can't do that right now. I'm too busy doing the stuff I do.
Well, that's great, I think, that you're
busy
doing the stuff you do.
I really enjoy it. I don't enjoy traveling. I enjoy being here in Berkeley in this gorgeous new place that I can't wait to play in tonight. But getting here kills me. And I have a horrendous 24 hours ahead of me. Nevertheless, I love what I do.
It went zip when it moved and bop when it stopped and whirr when it stood still. I never knew just what it was, and I guess I never will. When I was just a wee little lad, full of health and joy, my father homeward came one night and gave to me a toy. A wonder to behold it was, with many colors bright. The moment I laid eyes on it, it became my heart's delight.
It went
This is John Fast. Join us next weekend and keep reaching up.
Write to us at celebrateradio@yahoo.com. That's celebrateradio@yahoo.com.